When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled around a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to another episode of History Hack. We've got something, the concept sounds really vague, but it promises to be really interesting. Chris, what do we have?
Well, as you know, this is something I've got quite a weird interest in, what with the Northwest Passage and Franklin and then the German army in the Second World War. So we've got Max Leonard, who is a journalist and historian whose previous books include The Lantern Rouge, Bunker Research and Higher Calling, but he's here today to talk to us about his new book, A Cold Spell, A Human History of Ice. So, Max, welcome to History Hack. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm good, thanks. How are you?
So this is going to be really interesting because I certainly have never thought about how we interact with ice and how that's evolved over time. And there's a huge span in this book. So let's start with prehistory then. What do we know about how our prehistoric ancestors interacted with ice?
But yeah, you're right. The book takes a huge time span and it's a little bit of a case of biting off more than you can chew, but definitely starting in prehistory, it's an interesting challenge really to try and work out what exactly we can say about what happened when humans first met ice. It would have been colder then, so there would have been ice in sub-Saharan Africa where humankind emerged from. You know, we're thinking back maybe 75,000 years ago, which is when Homo sapiens kind of definitively left Africa. But I don't think that going up mountains was something that people did until quite a lot later. You know, maybe we're talking, 17th, 18th century till that became really fashionable. So, you know, I was just trying to imagine really what happened when we first met ice as a species. And, you know, it would have been somewhere on our exodus out of Africa spreading across Eurasia and into Western Europe and into Asia. And I think one thing that you can say, which is very important, is that, you know, because essentially this is, when temperatures were falling towards the absolute low of the last ice age, the last glacial maximum, the lowest point of temperatures and the maximum extent of ice was something like 19,000 years ago, give or take. Ice would have really controlled where we could go, because if you think about sea levels would have been, you know, up to 100 meters, maybe, you know, probably more, even lower than that. So people would be able to travel places they couldn't travel now. People would have walked across from Europe into the British Isles before that was cut off again about 7,000 years ago. And the other aspect of it was glaciers would have stopped humans walking places where, you know, currently they can walk. There were huge glaciers across the north of the UK, across northern parts of northern Europe, across America. So that's one thing that I think you can really say. It affected our development, it affected our migration, it affected how humankind spread across the world. And the other thing that I became really fascinated by was, you know, what was this kind of shock that people experienced when you were in these cold, harsh environments, which was not, you know, would have been a new kind of difficulty for them to kind of overcome. And for a long time, that seemed, you know, it seemed quite speculative. But then there's been some very recent research by teams of people at universities in the UK looking at cave paintings in kind of southwestern France and places like that. And it was actually an amateur researcher, and he looked at these paintings and saw there were dot patterns on some of the animals depicted. And he worked out that the dots sort of corresponded to the month at which the animal, either when it was mating or when it was, you know, good time to be hunted, a good time to go and eat the animal. So really the thrust of this newish scientific article that came out last year, 2023, I think, was that these cave paintings were kind of like a ice age survival manual to help people live among this ice in this region.
So in terms of what we did with ice in history, that's one thing. But I think as well, what we can learn because of ice as well is something important and slightly different. So why don't we talk about that?
Well, I think one of the, you know, most obvious and kind of most famous ways that ice tells us about the past is in how it can tell us about past climate. And that's because when you look at ice from a long time ago, it has tiny amounts of atmospheric gases trapped in it, and also the very composition of the ice itself is dependent upon the weather or the climate of time when it was frozen, because it's kind of complicated, but it's to do with different isotopes of water molecules, and some of them are slightly heavier than others, and so they occur at different ratios depending on whether the climate was warmer or cooler. But this was all actually found out or proven by a scientist in the 1950s called Willy Dansgaard. He was a Danish guy. He'd started these experiments in his garden in Copenhagen with beer bottles catching rain and then testing, whether the weather was hotter or colder, and whether the rain in his beer bottles was, what the composition of the water was. But he took this research on and eventually went to Greenland and worked on ice cores. So when you drill down through the ice and remove a huge long core, and that's how you can tell what's going on in the climate in past times. And that was a really important part of establishing a link between gases in the climate and gases in the air, and climate. So essentially gases and temperature warming. But the other thing that I got really interested in when I was looking stuff in the book was ice mummies and the way that ice has preserved people, artifacts, things from the distant past, lives that we would not have known anything about otherwise. One of the most important of those is, and you call him the daddy of ice mummies, actually, he is Otzi the ice mummy. He was found in 1991 up a mountain on the border between Austria and Italy. And at first they thought that this body might be, might have come from the Second World War, or it might have been even a bit older than that. And it's not that unusual to find bodies in ice, that people, especially, a few hundred years ago, you'd have to travel across mountains in bad weather and people died and then their bodies got trapped in ice on glaciers, and then they'd reappear because of the movement of the glaciers processing very, very slowly downhill, then these sort of gruesome remains might be found at points. But with Otzi, it became very clear very, very quickly that he was way older. Eventually, with carbon dating, they dated him to about 5,000 years ago, something like just around 3,200 BC, I think. And because he'd been in an ice gully rather than a glacier, which flows, he'd been trapped in a gully. So his body was intact, and he had all these amazing things with him, made out of several different types of animal furs and skins, and, sewn with needles, and he had like a first aid kit full of mushrooms and things that we know have homeopathic properties, and he had tattoos. And he had a rucksack, and he had a bow and arrows, and none of this stuff we would have survived. So we'd know so much less about this time period, which was probably the late Copper Age, Copper Axe. But none of the organic stuff would have survived without ice, and that was super, super exciting to me. And there's a few other examples as well. There's the Ice Princess, who was of a nomadic horse riding tribe in Siberia, who was dug out close in time to Otzi. Actually, this was happening in the 90s again. again, she was found in a tomb, but she'd been encased in ice kind of accidentally. And in the tomb, there was sort of amazing fabrics from India, and she had a mirror, and she had the food that she'd been given to help her journey into the afterlife, that then when it was melted out, it started decaying and started smelling again, and all this incredible stuff that had been preserved.
So tell us then, what is the Little Ice Age?
Ah, yes, the Little Ice Age. That refers to a period in mainly in European history, but, you know, Europe and North America, it seems to have been a climatic phenomenon. And some would date it to around the 13th century, but then around the kind of 15, if I think this is right, around the kind of 1570s, around then, there was another marked lowering in the temperatures across Europe, across America. You can tell this from things like grain records and things like toll records on bridges, because ships couldn't sail because the rivers were iced up, and all these different ways that people are recording that they can't go about their business because the temperatures have dropped and there's, you know, the rivers are icing up. And in other parts of the world, it was just a lot of, you know, kind of from the records we know, it's kind of stormy weather or these sorts of things. But it was probably kind of a substantial drop of maybe, could have been a degree, it could have been a bit more. But we know now, what with the temperature rising, that you know, even if the average temperature is not going up so much, then you get these huge, you know, weather events and storms and things. And so a kind of small difference in temperature can make big differences in the weather. But one of the most interesting and funny things that happened because of this was that the Thames in London would freeze over. And I think it was something...
Yeah, exactly. Is it credited with killing off the plague? I have this vague recollection of seeing somewhere that when the Thames froze over that year, and that it did help sort of eliminate the pestilence and save London.
Yeah, exactly. And it would free something like 24 times in a few hundred years. And so people would go out onto the ice and put up tents, and then someone would like make a fire on the ice and they'd start roasting an ox. And it would be also sort of fairground games and licentious behavior, and they'd put a printing press on the ice and print little pamphlets and poems to commemorate the occasion, and pamphlets that might have been, you know, not allowed. It was a sort of carnival atmosphere, and it was a kind of temporary upside down world in which, you know, anything goes. But then you had to be careful, because after a certain period of time, the ice would just melt away, and everyone, you know, if you weren't quick, you'd fall through and lose your life.
So tell us about early explorers. How were you able to kind of define how they interacted with ice?
Well, what I liked about the early stuff, I mean, Chris is right that there's some really well-known things like the Franklin disaster of 1845 to 1848, which was when the ship headed by John Franklin, two ships actually, went off to try and find the Northwest Passage to you know, find a new sailing route up over the top of America and actually round to the east. But they disappeared and hundreds of men died and they weren't found for a few years, but it was all sorts of, it was gruesome cannibalism and things like that. But what I found fascinating was that this quest for the Northwest Passage to find an easier sailing, quicker sailing route to the riches of the east, it's been going for hundreds and hundreds of years. And in the early days, what really struck me was that these people zero idea of what they were getting themselves into. You know, there were very, very few records of what was going on up in the like icy north. And so, you know, there were a few Greek sailors, ancient Greeks that had gone up there, but actually it was, you know, the ice was just a complete and total unknown when they were looking up at there weren't maps, and so each voyage would be a kind of voyage of hope and opportunity and possibility, but they'd seem to get repelled, you know, all the time by walls and walls of ice. And, you know, I'm thinking of people like Frobisher, Martin Frobisher, and lots of names like that who've now given their names, in fact, to kind of bays and to straits and things in Canada and Alaska. And one of my favorite people was called Sir Humphrey Gilbert, and he was absolutely obsessed by trying to find a way through the ice up over the top of America. He was the half brother, I think, of Sir Walter Raleigh, and spent a lot of time trying to convince Queen Elizabeth that this was how she should be spending her money, letting him go over there and try and make her riches like this. But what really happened to him was that once he did go, he kind of established a colony in Newfoundland, so on US, on North American soil. And once he got there, he sort of realized, I don't need to go any further. I sort of made things too difficult for him. So he sort of concentrated his activity on exploiting and looking at this new land that nobody was really using at the time. And it seems to me that this kind of impossibility of getting through the ice.
Right. So we've established that explorers like to go poking around on it, but what about scientists? What do they make of it throughout history?
Yeah, well, it's funny because it was around this same period of time, the kind of 17th century, when the kind of one of the golden ages of exploration geographical exploration, I mean, was going on, that kind of scientific exploration was happening as well. And I mean, like on quite a lot of things, that the Chinese seem to have got there before us. I mean, we know that in antiquity, that ancient China, that people understood that snowflakes were six-sided. I think you can see this, you know, with a big dry snowflake, you can see it's a hexagon and, you know, it has six-pointed star kind of shape. Although I think the Chinese might have used lenses as well, but they really had this information quite a long time before us. And actually the six-sidedness reflects the molecular structure of water and ice. But it took probably till the 17th century until in Western Europe, we were really trying to do our own experiments into this. And Descartes started looking at snowflakes. Robert Hooke, and in his famous book Micrographia, when he was using a microscope for, you know, pioneering the use of the microscope, he was looking at snowflakes and you know, frozen water particles. But the kind of most interesting guy in that time period, or the one who was interested in ice most extensively, was Robert Boyle. And he wrote a book called New Observations Upon Cold, Touching Upon Cold, which sort of summarized 7 years, 10 years of experiments into ice, into cold, because really people found the idea of cold very, very difficult to understand. I mean, if you think about it, heat, you have a fire, it's kind of obvious what's going on there. But cold, there's nothing that seems to be causing it. And it was very difficult to know, was it a substance in itself? You know, Aristotle and people thought heat and cold were substances, or was it an absence of something? Or, you know, water, and water especially, and ice in particular, they were very, very puzzling too, because, you know, why did ice form? What was it? Why did it float? Why does ice get bigger when it freezes? Because, you know, does that mean that something's being added to the water that used to be there? Is there air in it? So many questions that were very difficult to understand. But by investigating ice, we were starting really to get to the bottom of kind of important scientific principles. The idea of molecular structure, how the natural world is constituted, all came really from this study of ice.
Really is fascinating to think about all the ways that we've interacted with it in history. I think one of the ones that springs to mind first, and I think it probably goes back way longer than we thought it did, or you might assume, is food preservation. So how does that work?
Yeah, well, we think so. I mean, there was ice and food is a huge subject, and it's one that's really fundamental to how we have now constructed our cities and our societies and you know, how we live our lives today. And I think you can think about ice and food in two ways. You can think about it as ice is something that preserves food, but also ice is something that we consume, or maybe we don't consume so much ice, but the idea of cold drinks and that sort of thing has been, you know, very popular since ancient times. And on the storage side of it, I mean, there's records of indigenous people in Alaska who've used kind of cold storage caverns dug into the ground to store meat and things. And one particular ice historian has conjectured that there's certain kind of prehistoric pits that have been dug in the UK and other places. She conjectures that they were ice pits used to store, you know, to store ice, probably to store for food. But, you know, the ancient Greeks knew that ice preserved food. The Chinese, ancient Chinese again, knew that ice preserved food, that you could store fresh food in cold conditions near ice, and it would lengthen the life. But curiously, it doesn't seem to have been that useful to people until relatively recently. It's strange. I mean, you know, now it seems so fundamental that we keep things cold and we put them in the fridge.
Do we think then that the dividing line is sort of the fact that they didn't have control over making it? If it was there, they could utilize it, but they couldn't fashion it.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think it's, you know, as, like, you know, it was a total mystery what was going on. Like we were just talking about with the kind of scientists, and all around the Mediterranean and in Italy and in France and in places that you wouldn't think about, like Lebanon and Mesopotamia, which is now Iraq, they would collect ice, or they could collect snow from the mountains and bring it down and then pack it into ice stores very, very tightly and insulate it very well. And that would keep this ice, you know, it packets until it became ice, and then it would keep for ages. And they'd mainly use it to chill drinks. I think it was a sort of luxurious thing for rich people to do, and for the kind of elites of the you know, city states at the time. But I think partly is that people didn't know how to control it, and it wasn't obvious how to get it and store it. But also that it just wasn't really that important to them to keep stuff. That, you know, you ate what was there in front of you, and then, you know, as the season moved, you'd eat something else, or you know, you pickled it, or you made it into jam, or something, you know, all of these different things.
It's like so many things in history, isn't it? It didn't become a necessity until it was one, I guess, just like the internet today.
Yeah, totally.
If you're wondering why Chris isn't saying anything, it's not because I'm hogging the episode. He's having tech issues, which is really sad for him because he was so excited about this episode. So he can sit there and listen to us, but he just can't get involved, which is quite sad. But the next question he wanted to ask you is about glaciers and mountains.
Yeah, and I think it, you know, it goes to, you know, the kind of things like the Industrial Revolution and you know, how our lives have changed. You know, suddenly, you know, people are very concentrated in cities, and they're working in things that are not agriculture. So there's a huge, you know, increasing populations in the 19th century, certainly in Britain and in America and across Europe, of people that need to be fed but aren't producing food themselves. And in America, you know, Americans became kind of specialists in ice and food, and, you know, Americans love ice in their drinks. If you've been to the States, so you get like a huge, you know, huge glass, but it's totally full of ice. And they come to Europe and they think, when you get, you know, you go to Italy and you get a Coke and you have two ice cubes in it, they think it's bizarre. But because they had the temperature extremes in America and huge distances, you know, they could harvest ice from the lakes in the Northeast, and then there were guys who would ship it to the southern cities, to kind of, I don't know, New Orleans or Savannah, Georgia, and, you know, people would put it in their drinks. But also it meant that if you were a cowboy in the Wild West, if you were in Texas, or if you were, you know, in that march of America, settlers going west and laying waste to everything and making, you know, taking cows and produce with them, that, you know, if you could ice your produce up and carry it across America in trains, in refrigerated carriages with ice, and with ice that was refreshed at certain points along the way, then suddenly, like, you were giving money to these guys, you know, out in the West, and they were selling a product that was useful to the people in New York or in the other big cities of the West. So it kind of helps that kind of industrialization, that colonial project. And you can see it in America, but it's, you know, to an extent it was true in the UK, which is a lot smaller. You know, people would, the advent of using ice to preserve things completely changed the salmon industry in Scotland, because it meant that you could send salmon down to Billingsgate Market in London, or, you know, so you could take it from where it was abundant and give it to the people who wanted it without it going bad. So that really was the start of, you know, the modern food supply system, and you know, how we produce and consume things today. And I didn't, you know, kind of my book and my interest stopped a bit when we stopped using ice itself and we started making artificial refrigeration, because really, in this whole process of storing food, ice is just the middleman. It's not necessary. All you really want is something to keep it cold. But the one guy who I thought was quite funny, who was on the cusp of that, who was on the edge of that moment when they were moving from using ice to freeze things to just using, you know, chilled gases and refrigeration like we have now to chill things, was a guy called Clarence Birdseye. And Clarence Birdseye was, as you might expect, quite into his fish. He was actually, he worked for he was an American, and he worked up in Labrador as, I think it's something to do with the park ranger system, something like that. But he learned from the local indigenous people there about fishing in ice holes. And he saw that if you pulled a fish out of the water and it was minus 30 degrees outside, that fish would freeze instantly. And then if you defrosted it a week later or a month later, then it would be way, way better to eat if it had been flash frozen like that than if it had been, you know, just chilled or, you know, frozen slowly. It got all mushy and not really all that, not all that appetizing. So he took this insight and kind of industrialized it and made Birdseye food that we know today. So really, that was the start of the fish finger.
So what is the permafrost of 1799 and why is it important?
Yeah, I mean, I tried to keep my, you know, I tried to keep it quite focused on how we brought ice into our world rather than us going out and exploring the icy world. You know, there's a whole ton of books on, you know, there's whole libraries of polar exploration and that kind of thing. But I thought that the Alps and the way that we explored the Alps was actually quite interesting and quite important to ice and society, I guess you'd call it.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I think one aspect of that is that the first guys who went up into the Alps, like we were talking about earlier, they were actually scientists. So they were going up onto the glaciers near Chamonix and places like that in France, in the Alps, and doing experiments and doing barometric experiments and that kind of thing. And So really collecting data about the natural world. So another great example of scientists in the Alps was Louis Pasteur, who you probably know, well, at least from the word pasteurization. So, you know, working out how to make food safe by removing microbes. And he did a lot of his experiments on glaciers too. And then there, after him, there were geologists who would go up and who were kind of trying to using glaciers and rock formations and that kind of thing to understand the processes that formed the earth and that led to the landscapes and the geographical and geological features that we know. But alongside that kind of scientific current, you've also got the kind of, you'd call it a kind of romantic fascination with the mountains, with ice, and a big figure in that for me was Mary Shelley, who wrote Frankenstein after a trip up to a glacier near Chamonix. And you know, this kind of icy, desolate landscapes were completely inhuman and inspired a kind of terror and awe at the same time that, you know, people describe using the word sublime. So it's this idea of the kind of grandeur of nature, but the kind of utterly alien and forbidding and threatening nature of it inspired these kind of, you know, awestruck feelings. And Shelley would, you know, Shelley and her partner Percy Shelley would, you know, be very much associated with the Romantic movement. So that was kind of two strands. But then the final one is that the Alps is where this kind of adventure mentality got going. So we had, you know, once you'd explored, you know, once you'd started exploring, you know, someone would go higher, someone would go higher. Mont Blanc, the highest mountain in the Alps and the highest mountain in Western Europe, just outside Chamonix, was first climbed in 1786, and that really sparked a few years later, and people like Shelley and the scientists too. That really sparked a kind of race to go and climb all the mountains possible in the Alps, to go and claim the summits, quite often by British or Irish people, men mainly, but there were a lot of quite famous women climbers in the day who were shaking off the shackles of social convention at the time to go and explore in what was known as the upper ice world. And I think There's an interesting theory, or I find it interesting anyway, that Victorian society was becoming so kind of controlled and safe in a way that it hadn't been before, that people sort of went out and wanted to go out and take risks in a way that they hadn't before. And this, you know, kind of upper ice world was an outlet for this new feeling of having to, you know, break free and go and test yourself in a way that people hadn't done before.
Yeah, this is the exact time that everybody starts freaking the shit out, isn't it? Because of dinosaurs, because they start discovering them. And it's like, well, what if they were here before us? Then all of our dates are wrong.
Well, this is another thing that kind of relates to kind of big movements of thought in the 19th century. And in 1799, in the permafrost on the edge of the Polar Sea in Siberia, a mammoth started defrosting out of the ice. And mammoths had been, you know, mammoth bones had been found before. There was quite a big trade in tusks, and various bits and pieces had been known, but people were never really sure what they were. And, you know, if they'd been found, you know, if they found bones in the UK or in Austria and France, like, sometimes they were thought to be kind of giant humans or things like that, because it was just bits and pieces. But the real amazing thing about this mammoth in Siberia was that it was defrosting out of ancient ice that had been buried. Kind of whole, so it had its skin, it had tusks, it had mammoth hair, everything, and it came to the attention of a guy called Mikhail Adams from St. Petersburg, who traveled out to go and see it. I mean, this is weeks and weeks and weeks of travel, thousands of kilometers, and he rescued this complete skeleton plus, you know, kilos and kilos of matted hair and all this mammoth crap, basically. And took it back to St. Petersburg, where the skeleton was reassembled using an elephant skeleton as a guide. And this was the first mammoth that had ever really been seen by anyone. And the reason why this is important is that, you know, it really touched upon all the big debates that were going to start happening in the 19th century about how old was the Earth? Well, you know, what was the role of God in creating the Earth? You know, previous, you know, until fairly recently, Christian doctrine held that, you know, the Earth was created by God in 6-7 days, and Adam and Eve then came along afterwards. And there were people in the 19th century who would even date it very, very precisely to the earth was actually created in 4004 BC. Suddenly you have this thing that looks like an elephant but isn't an elephant. You know, it's obvious from the bones it's not an elephant, and what's it doing in Siberia anyway, and not Africa? And so had it been washed there by the flood, you know, when the flood receded, did it leave debris everywhere? And the Earth was also meant, well, species were meant to be static. You know, everything that ever was created had been created by God in 6 days, and then it was, you know, taken by Noah on the ark. So what is this thing that now doesn't exist? And so, you know, it's not as ground earth shattering as Charles Darwin, who'd come along, you know, he'd take his boat trip 30 years later and then publish in 1859 on the origin of species. But it was part of this whole, you know, revolution in thinking that would happen during the course of the 19th century.
So tell us about medicine then. How do our ancestors start using it and harnessing it to treat ill people?
I was intrigued by medicine. I mean, maybe I'd read too much Frankenstein, but you know, there was a sort of idea in my head that you could find something a bit gory and a bit gruesome. And but for quite a while, I didn't find that much that I thought was super interesting, actually. Like, you know, ice can be used as an anesthetic. People, you know, before there was gas used to put people out or drugs, you know, people would take ice and they'd hold it on the affected area. And quite often it was used by dentists, and that would be sort of temporary anesthetic. If you wanted a tooth out, or I think Napoleon had a very famous surgeon who would do battlefield amputations, and if it was freezing cold, then it would hurt less, you know. So people knew about that, but I didn't find that to be, that wasn't satisfactory. I thought there'd be something a bit more gruesome than that. And then I found traces of an anatomist, Dr. Wilhelm Braun, a German guy who had been in the military and then became a professor at, I think it was Göttingen University in Germany, doing experiments for the German military. But his interest in anatomy wasn't, most of anatomy, it's kind of classical anatomy, is kind of tracing systems and things throughout the body and obviously, you know, cutting things up and classifying things. But what he did was topographical anatomy. It was all about sort of making a map was inside the body and how things related to each other, what went where. And what he pioneered was a thing called frozen sectioning. So he'd get corpses from wherever he got corpses from, freeze them in a combination of water and salt to depress the temperature, to make the temperature much lower, for a few days until the body was completely frozen rigid. And then he'd saw it into sections, so you could see like a cross section of what was going on inside people. Then he'd rub it with water so it froze and froze clear, and so you could see what was going on. And then he'd get a lithographer or an artist to draw it, so you could kind of trace around what was happening. So you'd get these amazingly beautiful, weird, detailed portraits of, you know, what was going on if you cut someone right down the middle through their nose, through their chest and down through their genitals. And then you could see exactly what was going on in this section of their body, or you could do it across their head or, you know, across an arm. And it seemed like a weird and gruesome pursuit, but his anatomical drawings were completely groundbreaking and transformed the way that people understood what was going on in the body. And you have this kind of weird moral equation of what was, you know, Is it okay to go and cut someone up and you know, do all these things to a body, but if it's going to save people's lives? And undoubtedly it did save a lot of people's lives, especially in childbirth. He was probably the first person to actually see kind of dead baby in utero and would, it's very difficult to describe because it's kind of gruesome, but he has a section of a pregnant woman with the baby in utero, and this sounds kind of repellent, and I find it really weird talking about it, but showing it to surgeons, showing it to midwives, showing it to professionals, but I mean, would have saved huge numbers of lives at a time when childbirth was a really dangerous, potentially very dangerous, and so it's that, how do you balance that kind of gruesome, weird thing that feels wrong, but it has such a positive effect, and I found him a really interesting figure.
It's like that exhibition, isn't it, a few years ago that created like a massive stink because the guy had used bodies and kind of skinned them and taken them apart layer by layer so that you could go and see how they were sort of made up.
Yeah, Body Worlds, Gunter someone or other, another German guy who's, and I think he's actually said that the process that he uses, he revived. It's like an ice and food, the use of ice to make anatomical drawings was actually quite short-lived, and it moved on to using chemicals to do the same thing, this guy Gunter von Hagens, that was his name, he did this thing called plastination, so essentially turn the insides of a body into plastic and then take it apart and display them in kind of weird ways, but yeah, exactly what he was doing is really in a direct line from what those anatomists were doing, and He claims there was an educational benefit to what he was doing. There was an educational benefit to the anatomist, but yeah, it was a sort of weird and freaky display as well.
So poor Chris is still valiantly clinging on in the background, and I know he's been waiting for this question because he would like to discuss, or he can't discuss anything, but he would like to hear about ice and war. So what can you tell us?
Ice and war. Yeah, it was a big sub, almost the last chapter, but
I'm laughing because he's literally just put yay in the chat and it looks so sad.
Yeah, here we go. What I found funny was that I think it was in something like 1905 that a 4-year-old or 1890 something in the town of Passau on the German border with Austria, a little boy fell into the ice, into the icy river, and was rescued by his playmates. And this boy, his name was Adolf Hitler, and if somehow his playmates hadn't been so nice and kindly, or the ice had, the river had taken him away, maybe the ice would have disposed of, one of the worst figures in history. I know, one of these counterintuitive what if moments, but really there are a couple of other points in especially in 20th century history that I picked out for where ice had made a big difference in war. First of these was up in the Alps again, where in the First World War, the front between Austria and Italy really ran right along the mountaintops of the Alps in between those two countries. So while most of the fighting was, the big bloody battles that everyone knows about and the horrible loss of life was happening in other places in the lowlands, there were relatively small numbers of men on each side camped out in makeshift kind of shelters at up to 3,500 meters up, 2 miles high at the top of the mountains. And even I discovered reading the research that people actually lived in the glaciers in Alps because it was a lot safer and even a bit warmer in there than being outside. So say you had a position at the top of the mountain, well, you have to get supplies up there, and there's no nothing up there. Maybe you've got snow that you can melt for water, but no food, no fuel, no nothing to build with, no trees, and so every single thing had to be carried up. But so these supply lines were incredibly vulnerable to being attacked. So there was an Austrian engineer who thought, hang on, why don't we tunnel through the glacier to shield our men from being shot at? And it sounds mad, and it was, because as I said, glaciers move. They were constantly having to shore up these tunnels and fall down crevasses and all sorts of things. It was, the air would have been noxious because you were, burning candles in ice caves, essentially. But, these tunnels went on for miles and miles and miles and were safer and better and you know, preferable to being outside getting shot at and getting avalanched upon and chilled by icy storms and things.
There's that day on the Italian front, isn't there? And Nikolai is going to kill me for not remembering the exact date, but I'm pretty sure it's 1916, and they call it like White Saturday or something, don't they? Because you've got something like 10,000 on both sides, and they're all killed by avalanches.
Yeah, that's the. It is something like that. It is thousands. I can't remember the exact numbers, but the weird thing is I think 1916 was a really, really, call it White Friday, but the weird thing is that it actually happens on a Wednesday, so I don't know where the Friday comes from.
That might be literally the most Italian thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, totally. And you know, this, it must have been miserable. They you know, there was definitely huge losses of life due to in individual disasters like that, but they do it, think that in this, they call it the La Guerra Bianca, the White War, and they do think that probably more people died, many, many more people died from cold and malnutrition and, you know, fighting against the elements than they did fighting against each other.
So moving away from the First World War, which is where I always get dragged to by myself, let's talk about the Cold War. Let's talk about secret missile bases under Greenland.
Yeah, well, this is a... Well, unsurprisingly, you might say this is a Cold War story, and it may be one of the coldest episodes in the Cold War. But Greenland had become quite militarily strategic during World War II, and Denmark had been invaded by the Nazis, and so America was sort of looking after Greenland, and they had bases there because it was a useful place to be for the North Atlantic and supply, you know, helping to keep tabs on what was going on in that particular area, which was crucial to the war effort. But but the military importance of Greenland continued after the war, and as relationship with the Soviet Union degraded and we got into the standoff, now known as the Cold War, turns out that the Americans, who'd been allowed to keep two or three bases by the Danish in Greenland, had started at one of their research bases to build underground city, like dug into the ice cap. What they'd actually do is they'd dig it and then they'd cover it over and they'd let the snow pile up on top again. So you'd have a bit like the glaciers in the First World War, you'd have hundreds and hundreds of men living in these tunnels. And you know, they said it was for quote unquote research, and undoubtedly they were doing some scientific research there. This is where the ice cores first came from, that people used to determine what was going on with the climate in ancient times. But I think the hidden agenda was that the Americans were planning a thing called Camp Century, which was a series of tunnels kilometers and miles and miles and miles long, in which they would hide nuclear missiles, which they could shuttle around on underground railways to go and shoot at the Soviet Union if necessary. Maybe they didn't read their history all that well, because, you know, the dangers of living in glaciers had sort of been proven in the First World War. But, you know, ice moves. Even an ice sheet, which is very, very flat compared to a glacier and a mountain, it's still flowing. It moves, you know, maybe a few centimeters or a few meters a year, but it's still moving. So all these tunnels were shifting all the time. And in their kind of experimental base, they put a nuclear reactor to provide power. I mean, it seems obvious, but this, the roof of the room where the nuclear reactor was kept on was sort of caving in. And so they had to constantly prop it up, and the walls would be sort of creeping, you know, slumping. And it sounds like absolutely terrifying that you'd think about putting a nuclear reactor in such a dangerous situation, and then having hundreds of people living near it. And, you know, it wasn't just people living. There was a barbershop, there was a church, there was, you know, a whole, what they called main street, running through this ice cap, with looking after all these men who were there for supposedly for scientific research. But it seemed like an absolutely weird and mad episode of the Cold War that's not actually very well known about.
This has just been absolutely fascinating. Max, thank you so much for coming on to talk to us all about ice and how we've interacted with it throughout history. Remind everybody what the book is called.
Thanks. It's called A Cold Spell, A Human History of Ice.
Outstanding. So, Max, thank you very much. Do make sure you get a copy of that.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.